Say it.
You're listening to the Auschamp podcast.
You're listening to the Auschamp podcast.
You're listening to the Auschamp podcast.
The Auschamp podcast. Podcast.
You're listening to the Auschamp podcast.
Hello everyone, my name is Kate and I'm your host today for the latest edition of Auschamp's podcast series. My colleague Howard will also be chiming in, so don't be too surprised if my voice changes suddenly. Now, in light of all the recent shifts in international affairs and the myriad of speculation surrounding them, we here at Auschamp Beijing thought it would be good to sit down and chat with a seasoned expert within the Australia-China space, the Honourable Bob Carr. So as many of you know, Professor Carr is a former Foreign Minister of Australia and is also the longest continuously serving Premier of New South Wales. He's currently the Professor of International Relations at the University of Technology, Sydney, and the Director of the Australia-China Research Institute, ACRI, that focuses on illuminating the Australia-China relationship. But without further ado, let us begin by hearing a summary of a recent talk Professor Carr gave here in Beijing at the Beijing Foreign Studies University regarding the changes that we can expect in the aftermath of the recent US elections.
The challenge for China with the Trump presidency, China has got an opportunity for global leadership. Whether it's ready to embrace it or not is another thing. Trump has walked away from leadership on climate change, or he says he will. You've got to judge him at this stage before he's inaugurated on January 20 by the commitments he made during the campaign. They tend to bind a politician, and 70% of the things American presidential candidates promise end up being their policy. But America has also walked away from leadership on trade as a result of Trump saying that he will, on day one, end work on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So there's an opportunity for China here, and China's got to think about that. I think China's showing leadership now by using diplomacy rather than forcefulness in the South China Sea, and that is very encouraging. And it could well emerge as an example of the benefits China accrues from soft power as opposed to assertiveness.
When you talk about the opportunity inherent in China's leadership, it reminded me of the way that a lot of businesses see China as an economic opportunity. So do you see that Chinese leadership could also give businesses an opportunity?
I think businesses are waiting for more evidence of internal economic reform. I think China's opening up has a long way to go when it comes to sending a message to foreign investors that they're welcome, their treatment will be fair, and there are a lot of opportunities in the continuing opening up and reform in China. It'd be very sad if the work on an investment treaty with America were to cease.
And how do you view the Chinese innovation zones?
I think hugely impressive. I've seen them in Chengdu, I've seen them in Shenzhen, and everywhere you go in China, but especially in places like that, you're encountering businesses that are at the cutting edge. And they may be ahead of the relevant American businesses. The big statistic for Australia and the world is that in a mere 14 years' time, China is going to have another 850 million people in middle-class status. That's a mere 14 years off. That's like a whole new world for Australian exporters, for Australian businesses.
If China is this economic opportunity at a global scale, it's quite clear that Australia is not going to be the only country who's going to realise that. So how do you think Australian businesses can have a competitive edge within China to really succeed here?
Well, the think tank I'm director of, ACRI, the Australia-China Relations Institute, has produced a report that shows the challenges are very real. Exactly as you say, in beef and cattle exports, we've gone backwards. Now, with more Chinese moving into middle-income purchasing power, you'd expect the reverse to be true. They'd be buying more meat from Australia. So that's going to take more work. It's balanced, of course, by the great success stories with other exports, like wine, for example, colossal increases, including this year on last year. We're not the only kid on the block. So, yes, it is impressive that we've got 1 million Chinese tourists coming to Australia every year, but it's a pretty low share. Japan's able to attract 4 million a year. So we've got to work harder. The competition is real. And if we start saying no to Chinese investment, there are other places they can take their capital. I don't think that's happening. And I think the story of Australian Chinese investment in Australia is pretty positive.
How about regarding higher education, so maybe attracting more Chinese students to study in Australia? Do you think that the changes in America's leadership could offer an opportunity to kind of change the balance at least a little bit more in Australia's favour, because so many Chinese students right now are choosing America's first choice? They don't even, Australia is sometimes not even on the list.
Yeah, I think the Chinese are pretty astute at buying products and services. They're capable of making a distinction between a foreign policy position struck by the new American administration and the value of American universities for their children. Were there to be a strong impression congealing that America doesn't welcome China and the Chinese, it could feed into a bad image for American education. In that context, it would suit Australia. It's just another example of where our interests aren't always the same as those of the United States, and I damn sure hope we aren't following, we'll never be tempted to follow, the foolishness of what President-elect Trump has done in unravelling the diplomatic foundations of US-China policy.
I'd like to ask a follow-up question regarding your earlier comments about TPP. And also yesterday, during your talk at the Foreign Studies University, you mentioned that because Trump has been elected mainly through the white supporters who supported him, and they are mainly in these states where big manufacturing industries are no longer there, in order to give back to them, one symbolic thing, or probably the only card that Trump has, is to go back on the TPP. So how do you see this? China came with RCEP, which is the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. And many believe that if TPP does not come into process, RCEP will take over. And by doing this, America might lose its grip in the Asia-Pacific trade. What is your thought on this?
Well, I think if America says we no longer stand by the TPP, the world will be drawn to the other available free trade implement, and it's one that's been sponsored, supported by China. So America has to accept that it won't be writing the rules. The rules will be written by others. And this confirms that under Trump, so far in these two respects, climate, it seems, certainly trade, America is vacating the global strategic leadership that the world took for granted from 1945. And there's a price to be paid. Others will have the chance to write the rules. And this is where my think tank comes in respect of Australia. We're illuminating these choices for Australia. And my strong advice, based on our work, is that Australia should not get dragged towards Trump's positioning. And I don't think we will, because I think Malcolm Turnbull's got too much common sense. And the Australian people know that our links with China are overwhelmingly to our advantage. It's not in our interest to go along with a policy of adversarial relations with China.
I had another question regarding something you mentioned yesterday during the talk as well. You talked about the Lowy Institute opinion poll, and you said that the younger generation, like especially, were shifting towards China in favour. So I think you quoted maybe, was it 51% as opposed to...
Yeah, and we've got to be careful of what the question was. The question was not whether you like China more than the US, but what country will be more important for Australia's future? And it's very interesting that younger people are saying China is the one that'll be more important.
So I wanted to ask what you think the role of youth would be in this process of perhaps helping Australia make a choice.
I think doing what you've done, Kate, and that is coming up to China, studying, working, travelling in China, getting to know it. I think to the first thing is to see China and to see its new city, because that impresses people on the opportunities that are here, the extent of the economic transformation, the shift to an economy based on consumption and services. It helps people shed an old image of China as the factory of the world. So I think getting here is the the most important point for young Australians.
And how do you feel more generally about the sort of shift in Chinese development policy from really focusing on trying to like shed the image of made in China to created in China?
Yeah, I think that fits in with the evolution of an economy that right now is 70% consumption. These are the features of the characteristics of a modern economy. And this is happening with China. And probably Australians don't realise the extent of this transformation. As a think tank, we brought a group of senior Australian journalists up here. They hadn't been, as a rule, they hadn't been to China for years. They hadn't seen the modern China. It was just important to get them here to see it.
And until you go to China, it's impossible to really comprehend
the change
that's going on.
They've got to see it. They've got to walk, as I say, the streets of Chengdu and see, visit some of the industries in Shenzhen, to see the modern architecture of Beijing. They've got to see it for themselves.
And just to bring back the discussion to maybe more industry-specific topics, of course, CHAPTA is the other big thing in the air. How do you think CHAPTA will fare in this new context of a Trump administration? Do you think there'll
be... Well, it works for Australia and it works for China. It's getting Australian products in supermarket shelves in China at a time when more and more Chinese are getting their food from supermarkets and from village markets.
Right.
As the country urbanises and becomes middle class. And if Trump closes down or winds back the economic integration between his country and China, I'm not sure he can do that, even if he wanted to.
Yeah.
American business would tell him that they don't want that to happen. Then there'll be more opportunities for Australia. So we should be a bit attentive to our branding.
Branding.
A bit attentive to our branding. America could end up being sullied by the negativity to China that Trump is already emitting.
I've read that during your premiership back in New South Wales, you introduced a lot of environmental policies, for example, like expanding the number of national parks dramatically. So like, what are some of the suggestions you can give to the Chinese policymakers regarding the environment?
I wouldn't be bold enough to give them suggestions because I think they're on the right track. I think the environmental problems are so pressing in China, they feel public pressure to clean up the air and the water and to save the natural world. I think the change in their position between Copenhagen and Paris on climate change was very, very significant.
Then why would you say when even China, who has been against all these environmental agreements in the past, is now changing its position, why do you think America is actually going backwards now compared to before?
Well, one possible explanation is that America is in decline. It no longer gets its way in the world. It's launched two wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, that it's lost. It's defied by North Korea. I could go on with other examples, but that leaves Americans thinking they're no longer a great country. It's lost its manufacturing sector as its economy has changed, and again, that feeds a discontent. The racial divisions are, by some measures, getting worse, and that's a sign of a country in trouble. Race was a big factor in this campaign. American society has done great things, but it's got great failures. For example, it hasn't got over the Civil War. It hasn't got over slavery. And it can't deal with the problem of gun violence, because that's imbued with all sorts of social and political significance. And it hasn't rewarded its working people. They've had no increase in real wages for 30 years. It still hasn't provided comprehensive health care for all its people. Every other advanced country does. So all these instances of American exceptionalism mean America has got its share of neuroses. And if you add them all up, it's in a bad state of health. And predictions of American decline have been made in the past. No empire lasts forever. You can't be dogmatic about it, but America has got pathologies walking the land.
Since we've touched upon these very political topics, I can't help but want to ask what you feel about changes in Australian foreign policy and whether this shift gives it potential for maybe greater Australian involvement in global affairs. We're talking about American leadership, we're talking about Chinese leadership. But what about Australian leadership on some of these issues? For example, climate change. We have great research institutions, and why shouldn't Australia be the one to lead the way in some of these?
Yeah, I'm disappointed that Australian politics hasn't fostered world leadership on climate change. Now, I'm not going to rehearse the history of that. It's been a challenge in Australian politics since 2007. John Howard, he was something of a climate change denier until public opinion forced him to commit to an emissions trading scheme. If John Howard had won the 2007 election, we'd probably have it in place. As Premier, I had a scheme that priced carbon, that applied to the output of the power sector alone, but it did have pricing, it did have penalties. So it is a big failure of Australian politics, and Australia's got to be careful that we don't end up looking like a country with hardening of the arteries, prematurely old.
But even if we don't just consider climate change, what about other spheres? Like, there's always a danger of seeing China, the relationship between Australia and China, is just the next step of finding another great and powerful friend. And there's always hope that Australia may one day move beyond this tendency.
Well, I think this is all tied up with ideas of American decline and American isolationism. Changes in America could force Australia to commit to more self-reliance and more Asia in our foreign policy. But we're only speculating about the direction America might take. There are elements of adventurism and elements of isolationism in Trump foreign policy.
So it's just that I'm curious because, you know, historically there was the relationship between Australia and the British Empire. There was a very similar idea of British decline of British Empire and withdrawal from the region.
Yeah, it happened suddenly. Happened suddenly with the British. Yes. It happened suddenly with the British. But who knows? It's too early to call the shots on that being analogous with America.
Well, analogies are always dangerous. So,
yeah, but they also illuminate possibilities, and that's all we're looking at this stage when it comes to this notion of whether America's in decline and whether that might force choices on Australia.
As the last part of the podcast, we'd like you to maybe give our listeners introduction of ACRI.
Yeah, Australia-China Relations Institute. It's the only think tank in Australia committed to illuminating the Australia-China relationship. There are other China study centres. You've got a host of American study centres and Australian universities, but we're the only one that's there to illuminate, to produce research on the Australia-China relationship. And that's our importance. And that's why we're supported by very big, well-known Australian companies, and I hope why we can attract Chinese companies to back us. We produce solid research. We produce simple fact sheets for our corporate members. We run events, and we bring Australian journalists to China.
And just to finish off on a light-hearted note, we do have this podcast tradition where we would like you to...
I'm not singing a song.
No, don't worry, not that light-hearted. Just to recommend a book to our listeners. It could be your favourite book of all time or something that you read more recently that...
Well, it's a book I'm reading now because we're going from Beijing on a holiday to Spain, and it's called Spain in the Golden Age, or the Golden Age of Spain. And it's one of those very good narrative histories that answers a lot of questions you had about a country and make you itch to get there and see some of the things it describes. So it's about the Spain of 1519 to 1680, when it really was the most important power. And I suppose it relates to what we've been saying, because it was inconceivable in the time of Charles V and Philip II that Spain would be irrelevant, or virtually irrelevant, to the rest of Europe. Empires rise, empires fade. That's the dynamic of history.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Nice to see you.
You are listening to OSCHAM Podcast. To learn more, visit our website at beijing.oscham.org.